Hi, and welcome to the Magazine Rack on Chris. I'm Michael Prinz. Today I'll be reading from Kiplinger Personal Finance. The first article today is written by Lisa Gerstner, titled, A Wealth Building Boost for Kids. I was sitting in my 8th grade algebra class when I first learned about the power of compound interest. On an overhead projector, the teacher laid out the math to show a group of 13 and 14-year-olds how much our savings could grow by the time we were in our 60s if we started to invest while we're young. 25 years later, I'm fuzzy on the exact figures my teacher used, but I remember being dazzled by the effects of starting early. Here's an example from Fidelity Investments. Say that at age 25, you start saving $6,000 a year in a retirement account, and earn an annual return of 7%. By the time you reach age 67, you'll have $1.48 million in your account. If you wait just 5 more years until age 30 to start saving the same annual amount and earn the same return, you'll have $1.03 million by age 67, leaving you with almost half $1 million less than if you had begun at 25. Even if you can't afford to set aside several thousand dollars a year, any amount you can stash away helps. Saving early and often is one of the core tenets of successful wealth building. Lend a hand to your kids or grandkids. If you have children or grandchildren, or just other young people you'd like to assist, you can help them get off on the right foot as they start their journey toward a flourishing financial future. Children who are old enough to earn money from work, even gigs such as babysitting or mowing the neighbor's lawn, can fund a Roth IRA. Yearly contributions are capped at the amount the child earns or the annual IRA contribution limit. In 2024, it's $7,000 for those younger than 50. Whichever is less. You can provide money to put in a child's Roth as long as the contributions don't exceed the annual limits. If the child is a minor, you'll need to set up a custodial account. On page 64, we detail the benefits of a 529 college savings plan, a tax-advantaged investment account in which you can sock away money for a child's future education. Thanks to recent changes in the Free Application for Federal Student Aid, the FAFSA, grandparents have a significant new advantage. Under the old rules, a 529 owned by a grandparent, or anyone else who is not a student or parent, is not counted as an asset on the FAFSA. But distributions from grandparent-owned plans are counted as untaxable income for students. Student income is assessed at a rate of up to 50% on the FAFSA, meaning that a 529 distribution of, say, $10,000 from a grandparent's account could reduce the student's aid award by as much as $5,000. But under the new rules, which take effect with the FAFSA for the 2024-2025 academic year, students don't have to report such cash support. That means grandparent-owed 529s will no longer affect aid eligibility. Finally, if you have adult children or grandchildren who want to buy a home, assisting them with the down payment can be a valuable gift. As we point out in the cover story, home ownership is still a good investment, despite all the challenges many buyers face in today's market. In 2024, you can give away up to $18,000 per person in financial gifts. Married couples can give $36,000 per recipient without filing a gift tax return. So, for example, you and your spouse could provide your child and his or her spouse or partner up to $72,000 in 2024 without worrying about the gift tax. Next, we move on to page 9 with, should you worry about being laid off? It depends on your industry. Downsizing has hit certain sectors, but cutbacks may be slowing, and some companies are expanding. Article by Sandra Block. The U.S. unemployment rate remains at historic lows, but that's a little consolation for workers who have been laid off in recent weeks. The cutbacks have been particularly brutal in the technology sector, affecting some of the nation's most well-known and historically profitable companies, including Meta, Google, and Amazon.com. The layoffs have also hit media companies and financial firms, forcing many professionals to add open to work to their LinkedIn profiles. But as dramatic as layoffs have been for the affected workers, they're not being seen in other parts of the job market. says Nick Bunker, director of North American Economic Research for Indeed Hiring Lab, a division of a job search website Indeed. Demand for employees in the majority of industry sectors remains above pre-pandemic levels, particularly in healthcare, wellness, beauty, and childcare. There are layoffs happening, but it's a small sliver of the population, and they're happening for reasons that aren't applicable to the rest of the U.S., Bunker says. In the tech sector, the layoffs reflect a pullback from the industry's rapid expansion during the pandemic, Bunker says. They overhired, and now they're reevaluating headcount based on demand for services or products, he says. The tech industry was also hit hard by the Federal Reserve's interest rate hikes, says Julia Pollack, chief economist for ZipRecruiter, an online employment website. When interest rates dropped to near zero during the pandemic, investors were willing to take bets on tech startups and other untested ventures, which allowed those companies to expand. Now, investors can find a safe return in the bond market, so there's no reason for them to throw money after risky new ideas, she says. There are already signs that the rate of layoffs is slowing and that the hiring is picking up. There were fewer layoffs in December and January than in the same periods a year earlier, Pollack says. And the median duration of unemployment for laid-off workers in January was 9.5 weeks, which is relatively low. Meanwhile, some companies are expanding, even in the technology sector, Pollack says. Social media giant Meta, which laid off thousands of workers last year, has said it plans to spend more on hiring workers this year in areas it considers critical to future growth. Nonetheless, in some sectors, such as software engineering, competition for openings is more intense than it was in the past. In February, tech-related job postings were down 25% from pre-pandemic levels and are down 2.7% from the previous 3 months, according to Indeed Hiring Labs. In addition, job seekers may have less flexibility when it comes to hybrid and remote work. Postings in sectors with a large share of remote-eligible jobs have fallen from 10.3% in February 2022 to 8.6% at the end of January, Bunker says. The decline isn't all that large, but if you're determined to work remotely, it's probably going to be more difficult to find a job than it was a couple of years ago, he says. In addition, those who work remotely may be more vulnerable to layoffs than those who come into the office. An analysis of 2023 employment trends by employer data provider Live Data Technologies found that remote workers were 35% more likely to be laid off than workers who come into the office. Getting back to work. If you're looking for a job in a competitive market, you can take steps to stand out from the crowd. Start by making sure your resume is formatted so it's easily read by the computer algorithms many employers use to screen applicants, Pollack says. Microsoft Word and Google Docs are usually compatible. Don't try to game the system by pasting the job description into your resume, but if you have the skills listed in the job posting, make sure you include them. Use artificial intelligence tools such as ChatGPT to critique your resume, and practice answering interview questions. Finally, don't limit your search to jobs within your industry. Indeed recommends expanding your search to positions that are in high demand to see whether they match your skill set. You may be able to apply your existing skills to a job in a new sector, at least temporarily. Protecting your finances. A layoff can wreak havoc on your budget, especially if it lasts more than a few weeks. These tips can help you weather the storm. Get a clear picture of your separation terms. Ask your former employer for a written notice detailing any severance you'll receive, along with any continuation of health insurance and retirement benefits. Apply for unemployment benefits right away. The sooner you file, the sooner you'll receive benefits. Rules differ by state, but you can generally get up to 26 weeks of benefits. You can find your own state's unemployment website at www.careeronestop.org. Search under Unemployment Benefits. Line up health insurance for you and your family. One option is COBRA, the federal law that allows qualifying workers to continue their existing coverage generally for up to 18 months. You'll typically pay both your portion of the premium and the amount your employer previously covered, plus a small administrative fee for a maximum of 102% of the total cost. If that's unaffordable, a less costly option may be an Affordable Care Act plan. You'll need to apply within 60 days of losing your job-based coverage. You can access the marketplace at www.healthcare.gov or through your state's healthcare exchange. Create a budget. Review recent bank and credit card statements to get an overview of your cash flow. Look for expenses you can cut until you start receiving unemployment benefits. This exercise will also help you estimate how long your emergency savings will last. Next, on page 12, we have an interview with Edgar Dworsky. He is a longtime consumer advocate and founder of Consumer World, which provides consumer news, alerts about common scams, and advice on how to save money. It's not your imagination. Your cereal box is shrinking. To avoid raising prices, some manufacturers are reducing the size of common grocery items. Here's how to fight back. Interview by Emma Patch. What is shrinkflation, and why is this phenomenon occurring? Manufacturers are facing increased costs across the board. Prices of raw materials, labor, and transportation have surged, primarily due to rising fuel costs. To offset these expenses, companies have several options. They can increase prices, but noticeable price hikes can lead to consumer backlash. Consumers are very price sensitive, and they'll notice if their orange juice goes up from $2.99 to $3.29 a carton. Another option is reformulating products with cheaper ingredients, but that risks compromising quality. They can absorb the cost, but that's not sustainable. So instead, many opt for a subtle reduction in product sizes, effectively implementing covert price increases that often go unnoticed by consumers. How can consumers combat this trend? Consumers must become vigilant about net weights. Paying attention to details like the number of tissues in a box or the weight of cereal boxes is crucial. You can use unit pricing on the store shelf to figure out which is the best deal per ounce or per 100 count. You can also complain to companies, explore competing brands, or opt for store brands, which tend to resist downsizing. With prices still elevated post-pandemic, what's the most effective way to save money on groceries? Most people live near two or three different supermarkets, so being selective and taking advantage of bargains is key. Before shopping, review supermarket ads for sales so you can identify the best deals and make bulk purchases to maximize savings. If an item is non-perishable and really a sensational bargain, why not stock up? Why buy only one bottle of apple juice if it's on sale? It's also important to develop price awareness so you can identify fluctuations and seize opportunities. Be aware of what you usually pay, $2.99 for XYZ cereal, for example, so you can spot a good deal when it's advertised, or when you're in the store, you can recognize when the price has changed. Vigilance against deceptive advertising is essential, although there hasn't been a lot of deception in advertising at supermarkets. Department stores, however, have faced scrutiny for misleading promotions, often inflating regular prices to exaggerate discounts. Do you recommend using coupons to cut grocery store costs? Using coupons, especially at stores offering double coupons, will save you money. Using digital coupons will also cut costs, but you need to load those onto your digital loyalty card account, usually before you go to the store, and that can be a pain in the neck. Unfortunately, consumers who aren't computer savvy are losing out on those deals. If you're one of those folks, go to the customer service desk and ask whether there's some way you can take advantage of the digital coupon prices. Some stores are beginning to make accommodations for seniors and others who can't use digital coupons. Next, on page 14, we have your vacation home could provide tax-free income. If you plan to rent out your vacation home, it's important to understand how your proceeds will be taxed. Article by Sandra Block. If you own a vacation home, there's a good chance you use it primarily as a getaway for your family and friends. But if it's located in an area that's popular with tourists, don't overlook an opportunity to earn extra tax-free income by renting it out. As long as you rent your home for 14 days or less during the year, you're not required to report rental income on your tax return. The exception applies no matter how much you charge for the 14-day stay. The rule also applies to your primary residence, so if Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band is coming to your town this year, you may be able to rent your home to fans of The Boss and retreat to your vacation home for the weekend. The IRS provision allowing individuals to exclude short-term temporary income is known as the Master's Rule, because residents of Augusta, Georgia, successfully lobbied for the exemption back in the 1970s so they could rent out their homes during the annual Augusta National Golf Club Masters Tournament. In enacting this provision, the IRS said such temporary rentals didn't represent regular business activity. The rise of Airbnb and other vacation rental services that allow owners of vacation homes to list their properties has made the tax break even more valuable. The rules for longer-term rentals. If you don't use your vacation home frequently, you may be interested in renting it out for more than 2 weeks. But be aware, though, that once you exceed the 14-day threshold, you must report rental income to the IRS. The good news here is that you'll also be eligible for a long list of deductions that will reduce your tax bill. Deductible expenses include your mortgage interest, utilities used, housekeeping, repairs, and even towels and sheets. However, if you spend more than 14 days a year at your vacation home, or more than 10% of the number of days the home is rented, the IRS considers the home a personal residence. In that case, you can only deduct expenses up to the amount of rental income you have received, and you can't deduct losses. Personal days include days you or a family member is using the house, even if the family member pays rent, along with the days you donated a use of the house, in a charity auction, for example, or rented it for less than the going rate for your area. Days spent on the property to fix it up, they don't count. As long as you limit your personal use to 14 days or 10% of the number of days it's rented, the home is considered a business and you can deduct all of the expenses. Depending on your income, you may also be able to deduct up to $25,000 in losses if your expenses exceed your income. For that reason, any vacation home owner who is thinking about renting it out should keep good records, not only of deductible expenses, but also of the number of days you stay on the property in relation to the number of days the home is rented. If you plan to rent out your vacation home for more than 14 days, you may want to limit the amount of time you spend there, so you can increase the amount of deductible expenses. On the right side of page 15, we have Making Amends, How to Fix an Error on Your Tax Return. Another article by Sandra Block. We all make mistakes, but discovering you made one on your tax return can be particularly unnerving. If you simply made a math error, the IRS will correct it. But if you've excluded information that could affect your tax bill, you should file an amended return. About 3 million taxpayers file amended returns each year, and the process has become easier since 2020, when the IRS began accepting electronic submissions of Form 1040X, the document used to amend a federal tax return. Previously, taxpayers had to file the form on paper. You generally have up to 3 years from the date you filed your original return, or 2 years from the date you paid any tax due, to file an amended return. However, if you fail to report taxable income, which may occur if you overlooked a Form 1099 from one of your brokerage accounts, or received it after you filed your tax return, you should file the amended return and pay the additional tax owed as soon as possible to reduce interest and potential penalties. If filing an amended return will increase the size of your refund, you should file as soon as possible to speed the delivery of your payment. You can track the status of your amended tax return online with the IRS's Where's My Amended Return tool. That's at www.irs.gov/filing /wares-my-amended-return. Or by calling 866-464-2050. On the bottom of pages 14 and 15, we have a calendar for May 2024. May 2nd is National Life Insurance Day. Take time to review your life insurance policy to make sure it meets your current needs. You may want to buy a policy or look for a better deal than the one you have now if you've undergone a life change, such as a marriage, divorce, or a new addition to your family. You can compare policies at www.acuquote.com or www.policygenius.com. On May 13th, even though the 2023 tax season has come and gone, you may still be on the lookout for your tax refund weeks after filing your return. The average tax refund was $3,123 as of late February, according to the IRS. No matter how much you're expecting back from Uncle Sam, if you haven't received your tax refund, track it at www.irs.gov/wares-my-refund or call the IRS refund hotline at 800-829-1954. Deal of the month. If you're looking for a deal on a major appliance, such as a refrigerator or washer, Memorial Day weekend is a great time to shop, says Julie Ramhold, consumer analyst at DealNews.com. Watch for sales on appliances at big box retailers, such as Home Depot, Best Buy, and Lowe's. On May 29th, it's 529 Day, a good time to open a 529 college savings plan for your children or grandchildren, or to contribute to accounts they already have. These state-sponsored tax-advantaged plans allow you to save for college, K-12, or trade school costs. You can compare plans at www.savingforcollege.com. Next, we have The Briefing, starting on page 16. Information about the markets and your money. The S&P 500 breaks a barrier. After the stock market reaches big round number milestones, investors typically split into two camps: those betting on more new highs, and those worried that a powerful bull run is about out of steam. The bullish camp is so far holding sway following the S&P 500's close above 5,000 for the first time in early February. By month's end, the S&P 500 had notched 14 new highs since the start of 2024, after hitting none at all in 2023. The broad market benchmark has returned 24%, including dividends, since its last low in October. Don't be surprised if the market pauses to digest recent gains, says market historian Sam Stovall, chief investment strategist at investment research firm CFRA. Large round numbers act like rusty doors and require several attempts before finally swinging open, he says. The market stumbled dramatically after a couple of reports showed higher than expected inflation, for example, and there have been signs below the surface that the bull is weaker than it appears. For the year to date, through February 29th, just 60% of S&P 500 stocks are in positive territory, despite all the record highs. But the market's fundamental underpinnings are healthy. Fortunately, economic activity appears solid, and corporations are once again delivering profits to shareholders, says John Lynch, chief investment officer of Commercia Wealth Management. If the past is a guide, pushing through a millennial milestone can presage further stock gains, says Stovall. The 12 months following previous 1,000-mile markers for the S&P 500, delivered an average gain of 10.5%. CFRA sees the S&P 500 trading at 5,250 over the next 12 months. When it comes to milestones, says Stovall, while short-term digestions of gains have indeed occurred, they have been fairly short in duration, so view them more as reasons to buy than to bail. Index makeovers. S&P Dow Jones Indices added e-commerce giant and cloud computing leader Amazon.com to the Dow Jones Industrial Average on February 26th, replacing struggling Walgreens Boots Alliance. Meanwhile, Uber Technologies replaced JetBlue Airways in the Dow Jones Transportation Average. The index, the oldest in the U.S., debuted in 1884 as the Dow Jones Railroad Average. And right below that, we have a black box that says 63%, the percentage of workers who had all of their 401k savings in a target date fund at the end of 2023, according to Fidelity Investments. Among Gen Z workers, those born between 1997 and 2012, the percentage increased to 84%. New FDIC rules for trusts. As of April 1st, trust accounts are subject to new coverage policies from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corps. Revocable trusts and irrevocable trusts, which were previously subject to differing and more complex rules, are being combined into a single ownership category. Each trust owner is insured up to $250,000 against bank failure per eligible primary beneficiary, up to a maximum of 5 beneficiaries. For example, if you are the sole owner of both revocable and irrevocable trust accounts at the same bank and have 2 primary beneficiaries, your coverage is $500,000 total. Depending on how your trust accounts are set up and their balances, your total coverage may increase or decrease as a result of the new rules. But many depositors will not see a change in their insurance limit, according to the FDIC. This little thing by Lisa Gerstner. Now, from the Kiplinger letter at the bottom of page 17, the best time to book a flight. Eager to book a trip? Purchasing your flight too early could cost you. The best time to buy a domestic airline ticket is 42 days before you travel, on average, for 2024, says a new study by CheapAir.com, an online travel agency. That's a lot closer to your travel date than in previous years. Still, that doesn't mean you should buy tickets at exactly that time, as other considerations affect airfares, such as destination and date. Typically, a flight's price changes several times in its lifetime, an average of $98 per shift, says CheapAir.com. For the second year in a row, the cheapest day of the week to fly domestically is Wednesday. Tuesday is the second cheapest. The most expensive? Sunday. Of course, time of year also matters. Summer flights typically cost more than winter. January is the cheapest month, followed by February, and November and July are the most expensive. Waiting until the last minute to buy a ticket comes with risk. Usually, the final days before a flight see big fare hikes, though sometimes there are last-minute bargains. And on the right side of page 17, Capital One aims to buy Discover, by Lisa Gerstner. In February, Capital One announced plans to buy Discover Financial in a $35.3 billion transaction. The deal brings together two major players in the credit card industry, and it creates the potential for Capital One to become the largest credit card lender in the country. Currently, Chase is the biggest. Discover is the smallest of 4 U.S. companies that operate a global payment network. The others are American Express, MasterCard, and Visa. Capital One, which issues cards on the MasterCard and Visa networks, expects the acquisition to make Discover's network more competitive with the larger networks. Discover also operates an online bank with consumer deposits, so the merger will further enlarge Capital One's presence in digital banking. The deal will have to clear regulatory scrutiny before becoming final, of course. A group of congressional Democrats are calling for the Biden administration to reject the merger, pointing to concerns that it would limit consumer choice in an industry that is already highly concentrated among a handful of large companies. If the merger gains approval, Capital One expects it to close in late 2024 or early 2025. All right, and that's going to be it for this installment of the Magazine Rack. I've been reading the May edition of Kiplinger Personal Finance. I'm Michael Prinz. So long, until next time, and thank you for listening.